Welcome to Flipper Talks, a family law podcast. We are Flipper, the Family Law Practitioners Association of Queensland. Family law is a wonderfully rewarding career, but is not without its challenges. Join us as we explore the issues that impact on the practice and well-being of family law practitioners. We hope our episodes will not only inform and inspire you, but encourage you to reach your potential. Enjoy this episode.
Hello, thank you for joining us today. My name is Helen Davison, and I'm a barrister who works in family law and a proud member of Flipper. Today, I have the pleasure of interviewing Dora Coe. Dora was admitted as a solicitor in 2011. In 2022, she was appointed a judicial registrar of the Federal Circuit and Family Court of Australia. In 2025, Dora commenced her practice as a private mediator. Today, we're discussing best practice when acting for culturally and linguistically diverse clients, or CALD family law clients. Dora, welcome.
Hello, Helen. Thank you so much for having me.
Dora, can you tell me a bit about yourself?
Yes, I can. So I'm Dora Coe. I am currently working as a mediator. I'm based in Brisbane, but I do offer my services to any and everyone who would like to brief me and would like my assistance, really. Thank you for reading out that background of mine. I'm originally from Hong Kong. I was born there and I came to Australia at the age of 9. And then I grew up in Brisbane, studied law. Straight out of law, I pretty much went into family law and have been in family law since.
Excellent. And you were recently awarded the Diversity Ambassador. Can you tell us a bit about your experience working with culturally and linguistically diverse clients?
Yeah, so I suppose because of my background and being able to speak a couple of languages, which are Cantonese, Mandarin and Japanese, I have naturally attracted culturally diverse clients as I've practiced in family law. And then particularly when I moved to work at Women's Legal Service in 2018, there were lots of culturally linguistically diverse clients that required assistance from the service, and a lot of them had intersectional issues. They had various vulnerabilities, language being one of them, and you know, they faced difficulties accessing, you know, support and services. So it really gave me that experience into servicing those clients and how to best assist them, finding ways to really be able to represent them well. And then as I went to the court, it was also really good opportunities. I mean, you see all sorts of matters that come through the court, and I had the opportunity and I consider it a real great privilege to provide some training to the registrars nationally about assisting really litigants, family law litigants, either in court or in court-based conferences. And then now I'm really passionate about that area. So now that's the service that I offer in mediation. And then since finishing up at the court, I've also had the opportunity to write various articles or to provide, you know, training, webinars, etc. So I'm really grateful that I've been able to share my experiences and what I've learnt throughout the years. And also, you know, thank you for having me here today to talk about this topic.
Pleasure. And, you know, for family lawyers who are, you know, have very busy practices and trying to keep up with legislation, amendments to the Act and things like that, why does a topic like this matter?
Yeah, look, that's a really good question. I think I agree with you that, you know, it's such a busy field and so much work. I think the topic matters because I think that's a reality for us moving forward if we look at our cultural landscape in Australia. So, you know, I looked through some stats and these are from 2021. So I dare say we've moved, forward since then. But the stats in 2021 showed that 51.5%, so more than half of the Australian population, is made up of first or second generation migrants. And that being first generation is that if they have, if they themselves, sorry, is was born in another country. And second generation is if they've got one or both parents that were born in another country. The top five birth countries are England, India, China, New Zealand, Philippines. And then the most common languages spoken other than English are Mandarin, Arabic, Vietnamese, Cantonese, and Punjabi. And then also, you know, going on from why I think the trend's going to be a bit different as we hit, you know, as we approach census in 2026 is that the top two countries where the immigrants are coming from are India and China. Mm. My personal view based on the experience and what I've encountered is that, you know, relationships are relationships, families are families, no matter the culture. And so, you know, there are going to be, unfortunately, relationships break down no matter what the background is. And therefore, there are going to be clients who will need our assistance. And from what I see and what I've encountered even whilst I was at the court is there are more and more culturally and linguistically diverse clients who need the assistance. So I think it's a really good time now to ensure that we're equipped, ensure that we can understand and work out, you know, some ways that we can assist those clients that will be coming through our door.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think, as you say, a vast majority of our clients, if not now, are likely in the future to be culturally and linguistically diverse. And I guess it's on us as practitioners to be as educated as we can to assist those clients, in the very best ways. What challenges do culturally and linguistically diverse clients face in family law?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think it's a very broad topic because I do think particularly for families, a cultural background really impacts many aspects of how families are. And I think also, I suppose when I really think about it, deduce six areas that I think, types of challenges that we might face. So the first one is the difference in their understanding of the laws or what they think the laws are. So, people who immigrate to another country, I think most of the time they come and set up and they're ready to start, afresh and they're excited. I doubt many people would research, the difference in their family laws. But then the issue is obviously if there's a relationship breakdown that happens in Australia, then the jurisdiction, is likely Australia. And so one example that I've encountered is, for example, premarital assets. Mm-hmm. There are some countries where assets that existed prior to the, start of the relationship or marriage, they don't count in the pool at separation. And so potentially you might have a couple that have got married overseas and then the wealthier party, thinks, okay, well, it's all safe then, that's all quarantined. And then lo and behold, however many years later they separate in Australia and the other spouse, suddenly has a claim for whatever is there, that's premarital assets. So that could be a real shock to them and that could be certainly something that they haven't planned. Another one that I think we might encounter a lot is, divorce. What does that mean? Is it a fault divorce system? Is it no fault? I certainly have come across clients who would seem to want to tell me all of the details as to what happened that led up to the divorce. And then when I get a better understanding, it's because what they thought was that they only knew that there was, a fault-based system in their home country. Mm. And so they thought I needed to know everything about what went on and what the private investigator found, which obviously is not the case. So that's, the difference in the laws. A big one is the difference in cultural practices. And I mean, off air, Helen, we were talking about, how that, I think particularly for parenting matters, that plays a big part. How do you raise your child what is culturally acceptable, you know, sleeping arrangements, you know, academically, what are they going to do, extracurricular activities, at what stage are you going to take the child to the doctor? You know, what is it? When? What's an emergency, medical emergency? I think that's all framed in some ways by what they're used to from their culture. And then, you know, if we're talking about property matters, you know, what happens with intergenerational wealth? What happens with the wealth from parents? We might see a lot of what's called gifts and loans, you know, what is then argued as gifts and loans because they're funds from parents. Well, how does that come about? Why is that practice so common in certain cultures? And why does it become such an issue when it's, you know, litigation, when there's litigation in Australia?
And are you able to answer that question? Because I'm sure we've all come, I've certainly noticed in some cultures that is certainly more common than in Australian families.
Yeah.
Are you able to shed some light on the intergenerational wealth and that type of?
Yeah. So, look, I'm more than happy to speak to it, but I do want to say that I don't claim to be an expert on all cultures. Mm-hmm. But based on what I understand servicing a particular culture of clients is that I through research and getting advice from those lawyers in the other countries or other jurisdictions, there are certain countries where it's actually in their law. So, for example, in China, it's in their civil code that parents or spouses, they have a responsibility to care for their children, to look after their children. But in that same section of the code, it says also their elderly parents. So what I learned was that actually it's within their laws that they're supposed to look after their elderly parents. Of course, there's no such responsibility, no written rule or law in Australia. And so my understanding is that then the elderly parents are going to go, okay, well, you are going to look after me when I grow old because you have to. And so then they would then have this concept of, okay, well, we're going to then assist you, for example, in funding your property, et cetera, because there's that expectations that they're likely going to live together. They're likely going to be provided for with some way. So you can imagine then that if there is a separation between those two couples, and the funds have only come from one side of the family, and there's an exiting party, well, the parents are going to go, well, why? You're no longer going to be looking after me. Why do you get a share of what we actually paid for? So, you know, it's neither a formal loan or a gift, I suppose, in our culture in Australia. Mm. But there's just those subtle differences. Now, whether or not that makes a difference in Australia, in your court, as you go to court and litigate those matters, I don't know necessarily. But I think it really does help to frame and make that clear.
It probably helps for practitioners to understand why then parents are fighting so hard.
That's right.
Often they want to be joined.
Yeah. And perhaps it is that if any clients come to you for, say, a BFA, a prenup, it is there maybe something to keep in mind. Maybe that's the time when you can really advise and help them, you know, address asset protection for them to understand, well, in Australia, we don't look at it this way. It's either a gift or a loan. There's no conditions up on, you know, this being a gift unless, you know, you separate.
Yeah. Thanks, Dora.
Yeah. So there's a few other challenges. So obviously a big one is the language barriers. And, you know, I know there's been new practice direction that even the courts put out, and that's based off the Judicial Diversity Council, you know, which has put out very helpful publications that assist us to understand how to use a translator and interpreter in the court setting. And I think I'd encourage everyone to read through that. I think what's really hard, though, is the actual, you know, the skills in using an interpreter. I think that's actually really hard. I think that interrupts the flow. And, I mean, certainly if anyone's seen me in court, so many times where I would just keep talking because it interrupts the flow, right? We're not used to stopping after every sentence. And also for clients, from their perspective, what I've encountered is that clients, their minds wander because they don't understand the other language. So they'll tell you one thing and then they'll be like, oh, hang on, there's all these other things. And it's quite disjointed. And then also there is, you know, what spoken language, you know, what's beyond the spoken language that an interpreter can't neatly interpret for you, what, you know, that context that can be lost. So I think there's certainly issues there, or challenges there, rather, if I can phrase it that way. Another one which I often encountered is when clients come and they feel like they've done research. Now, I think that's common for all clients nowadays, AI, Google. The issue, though, is that for culturally diverse clients, they probably have less access. Well, their access is limited because there's limited, you know, articles or, you know, publications that have been interpreted. So what I find is that for a lot of those clients, they actually rely on what the community tells them.
In terms of cultural practices, particularly in parenting matters, how have you seen culture be misinterpreted, say, negatively?
Culture be misinterpreted negatively. I thought about a matter that I had, you know, years ago when I was, you know, practicing as a lawyer in private practice. I had a matter where there were some court documents served up on us. The father was withholding the child, and there were various allegations made. One of them was that the child, you know, it intimated that the child wasn't being looked after well. And one of the issues raised was that the child had very severe infestation of head lice. Mm-hmm. And there were photos annexed to the affidavit, and, you know, I saw the photos and probably affected my appetite because it was very severe. And so, you know, this coupled with other things, you know, in the affidavit, you know, if I had just read that, I would have thought, well, this mother lacks capacity to attend to the day-to-day care and hygiene of the child. So I then pick up the phone and call the client and I ask her. And she's a client that is from mainland China, and she, you know, immigrated to Australia, you know, in adulthood. She said to me, well, what happened was I actually never knew what head lice was. I've never encountered it as a child, or, you know, when I was living in China, I've never ever encountered it. I didn't realise what it was. I thought it was an itchy head until it, you know, became a real problem. And it was actually the father, when the child was going to spend alternate weekends in the father's house, the father found out. And then as soon as he told me, I went to the chemist and bought everything I needed to treat it. So it wasn't that she didn't, you know, it was simply that she didn't know. And it, you know, it's not a matter of pain like head lice. It doesn't cause pain or anything like that, but it clearly doesn't, it would seem like it's unsightly, etc. But for this particular matter, that's all it was. Mm. And yet, you know, obviously we had to then spend, you know, quite a few paragraphs, maybe a couple of paragraphs in the affidavit to explain that and address that. But if I hadn't done that, if I had just been like, okay, this is like, you know, a matter where, you know, there were other things raised in there which I was then also able to explain. But then I think that I was able then to put that issue, you know, to bed, basically.
Yeah, because the difficulties I think particularly cold clients suffer from is, if you take an example like that where it was, you know, she didn't know what it was, but then what tends to happen, I find, in matters like that, that then everything she does, you know, I don't know, she put packets of chips in the lunchbox instead of, you know, fruit because she had a busy morning or whatever. Suddenly everyone's looking at then everything that
through
she
that
does
lens.
Through a lens of neglect.
Yes.
And you get this snowball of, you know, and it's easy then, you know, it becomes quite difficult for that client then to overcome it if it's not addressed straight away, like you were able to do.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's hard enough when you're dealing with one example, when you've got 10 examples and they all seem to point to neglect, for example, or mental health. You're really on the back foot. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the point early on in the matter, where you're getting an affidavit raising various allegations, really at that, you know, that interim stage, sitting down with your client and going, okay, let's talk about all of this. Because if there are cultural issues at play, and you don't have to phrase it like that with your client, it's just having a conversation and saying, oh, so did that happen? Oh, so why'd you do that?
Yep.
And what, oh, well, did you think about doing this? Oh, why didn't you think, you know, I feel like hitting it straight on is the best. Whereas yeah. if you're waiting till after the family report, this damning family report comes out about your client, it can be very difficult at that yep. stage to kind of mop up the mess and say, well, actually, there are all these cultural issues at play. But of course, my client didn't raise any of that during their interview.
Yeah.
So it's hard. And
I think the other thing that often gets misunderstood is the nodding. For clients who may not speak fluent English, mm-hmm. Or that when they're listening to you give them advice, they're nodding. It's really good idea to paraphrase and to double check, even if it takes more time, because I've encountered many times where the nodding doesn't actually mean they understand. Mm-hmm. They're nodding, it's just, okay, I acknowledge that you're speaking to me and I'm giving you my attention. I've certainly encountered in family law, but to, give you another, day-to-day practice, even a couple of weeks ago, had to make arrangements to come to the Flipper drinks event, which I had so much fun. Thank you for organising. It involved, one of my parents picking up my child at the swimming lesson. I only found out a week or so later that when I received an email from the swimming teacher, he actually had a message to tell me, but he told my mother. And my mother, and then I asked my child, who's 8 years old, and she said, oh, yeah, I forgot to tell you. But what happened was he told grandma, and grandma just nodded the whole time. Then grandma turned to me and said, what did he say? And so I think that's actually a really beautiful example. Even with my mum, who's been here for over 30 years, she's doing that. And actually, if I may, I could talk about this for ages, but it brings me to another point, actually, is that often we might see some allegations about a parent involving their children in adult matters. That could actually be the reality of some culturally and linguistically diverse families. When they move to Australia, they don't have the language. Well, guess whose English is the best in the household? The ones who are going to school.
Mm.
And so they're relied upon to read documents. And, from my own experiences, not necessarily myself, but from my peers, I know that happens a lot.
Mm.
The parents rely upon the children to read and understand those very formal documents.
Mm.
And so then, when they see a court document, they may not even know it's a court document.
Mm.
And so they just go, okay, well, can you read that for me? And they didn't even realise it's not appropriate. They're just trying to get by and understand.
Mm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it does. And I think, the example that I often see too is people who have actually lived in Australia their whole lives. They could have been born in Australia, but their parents are from another country. And so, they might have an Aussie accent. So we're not really thinking culture.
Yeah.
Yet culture, because they're still very heavily involved in a community full with people from a particular culture, they were raised by two parents from another culture. Culture is still, and particularly when I think it comes to parenting, because we often parent like our parents did.
Correct, yes.
And when we're asked for advice, we ask our aunts, we ask our grandma, we ask our mum and dad or
yep.
brothers or sisters and things like that. So often the advice and the cultural norms, notwithstanding they're living in Australia, they might have lived in Australia for 40 years.
Yes.
Culture is still playing a huge part in their lives. But yep. I think for us as solicitors, when we meet people like that, we're not necessarily thinking culture is an issue. And it's only when you kind of have to delve a little deeper.
Yeah.
If I can give one example, a recent example was acting for a mother. Now, one of the father's criticisms of her was that he was Australian, was she wouldn't allow him to be involved with the care of the child up to about 4 years. So she was responsible for, you know, bathing, feeding, all those things. And so he said, you know, only thing I was allowed to do was like read the child a book and take it to the park and things like that, put it to bed. That was it. I wanted to be involved and she wouldn't allow me. And he was saying that was evidence of her parental alienation and also some mental health disorder, or undiagnosed mental health disorder. When we spent a bit of time, or when the solicitor spent a bit of time with her unpacking that, what she said is, well, the culture that I was raised in, women do all of that work. Mm-hmm. Men do not change nappies. They do not bath children. That is just completely not the norm in our culture. And so, yes, I did do all those things. And yes, I did stop him from doing those things because I thought that's what good parenting was.
Yes, yes.
I didn't realise that I would be criticised for that, which she was heavily criticised for that.
Yep.
Now, from that time onward, she was allowing the child to have a relationship with the father. So, I mean, it's not okay, you know, and certainly it wasn't the case that she wanted that to continue. I think if she had said, well, going forward, and he can't have any time with the child because, you know, that would need some further explanation. But we put that in her affidavit, and we were able to explain the same with the cooking. She did all the cooking. He was critical that he wasn't allowed in the kitchen. And, you know, again, it was a cultural matter for her. So we were able to provide some context, which I think was important in that matter because, as I said, the allegations was that she was alienating him and her real motivation was that she didn't want him to have a relationship with the child, which we were able to explain that actually wasn't the case. So what I've experienced is kind of early on when those issues are being raised, even if the person I mean, you don't need to say, is it culture or is that why you're doing it? But it's just asking some questions and being inquisitive of your client and saying, this is being said about you. Why are we doing that?
Yeah, and I think you raised a really good point in that it actually doesn't matter how long they've been in country or, you know, who they are, where they're from, which culture. I think it's important to note that there is no one-size-fits-all at the end of the day. And I think actually being that culturally diverse, you know, country that we are, it does add some complexity in that there could be hybrids, if I can call it that.
Mm.
There could be different degrees of assimilation to the mainstream culture. So you just don't know, right? I can't tell you that every other Chinese Australian is going to parent the same way that I do, is going to view the same way or, you know, do the same things that I do personally. And similarly, other different cultures, you know, I might have adopted certain things. So I think as solicitors, it is important that, as with every other matter, is we take it as, you know, on a case-by-case basis. It helps when we recognise, you know, maybe some patterns, if I can call it that, as we encounter, as we, you know, service more and more clients from diverse culture. It may be that we realise there's certain things because there might be similar barriers that they face, similar experience that they face when they move to Australia, you know, just similar things. But there is also, there's no textbook answer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, each and every matter is different. And it could be, as you say, you know, it could be that there is, you know, alienation. You wouldn't really know, but it's always good to ask, is there something else?
Yes, yeah, that's right. It's not taking things at face value and asking the questions. And I think particularly when I've worked with culturally and linguistically diverse clients is you often do need a bit of extra time. You need to, those conferences often take a little bit longer because you might have a bit more questions than you ordinarily would, and I think too the other thing is addressing issues kind of as early as you can rather than being on the back foot and addressing them after, for example, a family report where maybe certain behaviours have been misinterpreted as alienation, enmeshment, and dealing with it after the fact is, it's almost much easier. And I think too, to prep your client, for example, if the other party's raising issues with their parenting,
mm-hmm.
and you talk to them and they say, well, yeah, that's because of my cultural background and that's how we do things, and it's not that I'm trying to exclude him, it's for X, Y, and Z, to say, okay, that's really helpful, let's ensure that we put that in your interim affidavit.
Mm.
Or if you asked about those practices with the family report writer, it'd probably be helpful for you to explain, the family report writer may very well know nothing about your culture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, make sure you speak up and you explain about your culture, but and including it in material early on rather, as I said, trying to fix it up, you know, later is always easier.
As you said, that, you know, court matters are likely to take longer, I think it's also important to be upfront about that with your client. You know, as you always would when you, you know, talk to your client, give them legal advice, you explain to them about the process. I think it's a good idea to address the fact that there are certain aspects, you know, in your matter that I'm going to spend more time on, that I'm going to be asking more questions about, and therefore my cost estimate is this or the other. The other thing that I think is really, you know, something to turn your mind to when you are assisting a client whose English is not fluent, whether or not you need an interpreter. As I said, there's a practice direction out there, so everyone can read through that. And there's also, you know, some suggested mechanisms to test. The difficulty, I think, with interpreters is that it's very, very expensive. And I think a lot of times lawyers are doing their best with their clients within the client's means, and they might look for ways in which they can make it work. I have read some cases, and I've had some conversations from when I was, you know, in the role working at the court, where there might be circumstances where the lawyers opted not, or maybe it's the client rather, okay, the client's instructions was not to have an interpreter at, say, a mention or a directions hearing. Because we all know how it works these days, right? It's mostly the lawyer that does the talking anyway, and it's procedural matters likely. I have read case law, though, that then it came to the stage of the trial, and one party seeks for an interpreter, and it wasn't granted on the basis that there were never any requests for interpreters, and there was no interpreters, and now finally at the trial stage. Now, I don't know, because I'm only reading those cases. I don't know personally what went on, and I don't know those clients. But I do wonder if there are circumstances where it was, you know, it seemed like at the time the costs outweighed the benefits when it's just a, you know, directions hearing or a mention. But it creates that perception, doesn't it?
It does, yeah.
And also what I want to say is a trial inherently is very different to a directions hearing. Being cross-examined and having to speak in your second or third or, you know, language whilst being cross-examined is a very different thing to just you and I having a chat and recording this. You know, the pressure could well impact your client's ability to comprehend and to clearly articulate what they need to say in the witness box. That might be the submission that needs to be made to the court. I don't know. These are just some suggestions that I have.
I think, though, if that's the case, or if you haven't, and clearly there's some matters where you, of course, would have an interpreter to everyone. If you've got a situation where maybe the client hasn't needed it because maybe they can understand some English, so it hasn't necessarily been, or as you say, for cost considerations, or maybe they didn't know that they could have that.
Or maybe you're really time pressed, right?
Yeah.
For lots of different reasons.
You tried an arrangement and you couldn't, and it was, you know, there could be 100 different reasons why you didn't have an interpreter at a mention. But the evidence in chief affidavit needs to address that. I would have thought if you're making an application then and you haven't had an interpreter at every court event, I think there needs to be some evidence from the client or potentially from the solicitor as to why then you're requiring one at trial. And I agree, there might be very good reasons, cross-examination being one, why a client would want that. I've also seen clients who can speak good conversational English, but still required an interpreter at trial, because obviously there's different language being used.
Absolutely.
They're obviously extremely stressed, and so it can sometimes affect cognition and things like that.
Yep.
And so there's lots of good reasons why you would have an interpreter. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I've had them there and said to the court, my client can speak conversational English. She hasn't had one. But we require an interpreter in the event she requests her interpretation of a question. And it might be in this particular case, it was one or two questions were interpreted. But at least we had that service there available for my client.
Yeah, it's also giving the court notice,
yeah,
isn't it? So the court has due notice of that application being made procedurally that everyone in the courtroom, all parties know, because having an interpreter at a trial makes for a very different trial, likely a lot lengthier.
Yes, yeah, and it should be raised at the compliance and readiness hearing so the court can then, put aside a sufficient time. If it's not, I mean, you can imagine that being one of the issues that a judge raises, that, okay, you've asked for 2 days and now you're telling me we need an interpreter, that's obviously going to push things back. Why wasn't that raised at the initial stage if it was so important? You really should have done that at the compliance and readiness, and there might be some skepticism as to why that wasn't done.
Yeah, so it's just good to turn your mind to it. Maybe have a bit of a checklist.
And I think also too, family report or psych assessment is another one where if your client is not proficient in English, I think you should be asking for one. The answers that clients give to questions from family report writers will haunt them, in my experience, for the rest of their matter. And I have had clients say to me, I didn't actually understand the question. I know I said yes to that. That should have been no.
Yeah, that's the nod effect. I think I'm going to call it the nodding effect, right? Yes, yes, yes.
And it's very difficult to undo that damage, and you're basically heading to a trial. If the yes should have been a no and it was a really important question, the same goes for a question obviously put to them in cross-examination.
I certainly think it would be best practice if there could be some joint agreed facts, and the court grants, seek the court's leave to provide that to the interpreter. Because if you really think about it, when you go into a trial, who's in the courtroom? It'd be everyone who's, who knows the matter, who at least knows all the basic facts, except for the interpreter. Certainly read cases, that I've quoted in some of the articles that I've read where, the whole morning of cross-examination was struck out by agreement because there was concerns about the accuracy of the interpretation. So that in itself causes a lot of difficulty and challenges. And I guess it is finding ways of how to overcome it. And I think it's one of them is, letting the interpreter have a little bit of background and then perhaps also, giving the opportunity to the interpreter to clarify if needed and creating that space. And sometimes I think, certainly when I've had interpreters or used interpreters, I'm so caught up with doing everything else, no matter what role I'm playing in the courtroom, I kind of forget that the interpreter may not know. The interpreter may be a lay person that's never, set foot in a courtroom himself or herself. And so they might be a bit anxious as to what's this whole formal process. And it's how can we do things to help the interpreter do his or her job to the best of their ability, which then in turn assists, with procedural fairness in the process.
Yeah, no, you make a really good point there. Thank you so much, Dora. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you today, and I'm sure our listeners, and I know I've learned a lot from our discussion. So all the best with your mediations. I hear that's going really well, and thank you for joining us on Flipper Talks.
Thank you. And by all means, if there's any questions from anybody, I'm more than happy to take them. So you can contact me directly.
Wonderful.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Dora.
Thank you for listening to Flipper Talks, a family law podcast. We hope you enjoyed the podcast today. We confirm that the information we discussed today was just that, information for educational and entertainment purposes only. It is not specific advice. If something discussed has you considering whether you should take steps, it is important to make sure you get professional advice about your unique situation before you proceed, whether that be legal, financial, accounting, medical, or other advice. Please reach out to Flipper if there's another topic you'd like explored, and if you know someone who might benefit from the show, remember to tell them about it. Thank you for listening.